In 1804, a British supply ship called Diligent rendezvoused with Admiral Horatio Nelson's squadron in the Mediterranean. The ship delivered bales of slop clothing intended for the use of sailors and marines on Nelson's ships, including the HMS Victory and the HMS Leviathan. After a routine inspection, the clothes were found to be of inferior quality, and they were rejected. Nelson and his commanders returned samples of the clothing to the Admiralty, along with letters discussing the clothes. In 2005, Lawrence Brockles, John Cardwell, and Michael Moss published a monograph about medicine on board naval ships, with a specific interest in the doctor aboard Nelson's flagship at the Battle of Trafalgar, William Beatty. In this book, they consider the role of clothing as a tool for maintaining crew health, but when they analyze the letters discussing Diligent's cargo, they frame Nelson and Hardy as giving clothing too much consideration. Hardy resembled a protective, thrifty matron fussing over children, they wrote, and continued that even Nelson exhibited mother-like concern. As a clothing historian who specializes in the apparel of working men in the Royal Navy, it is not surprising to see clothing dismissed in this way by naval historians, even ones writing about male bodies in the field of medicine and health. As an ostensibly all-male workspace, the Royal Navy and the maritime world more broadly have proven remarkably resistant to the incorporation of gendered theory, but the reality is that gender does not cease to be a consideration when men are not in the physical presence of women, and clothing remains significant even if it was designed by men, purchased by men, and was destined to clothe a man's body. In this talk for Global Maritime History's Conference on Toxic Masculinity, we are going to discuss the letters which Nelson, Hardy, and William Baton sent to the Admiralty about the inferior clothes that were delivered by the Diligent. These letters show that a gendered language of paternal care was used to position clothing as a duty owed to the ship's crew in return for labor. The concern exhibited by Nelson and his captains was understood by those in the Georgian Navy to be important and necessary. By contrast, the use of dismissive words like matronly and motherlike by Brockles and his co-authors instead reveal that modern historians still do not take clothing or feminine-coded care seriously, even, or especially, when it involved men. Rising in tandem with the popularity of gender theory and historical study, research focusing on clothing has developed into a popular and important historical field, especially studies of women's clothing. As both intensely personal and public objects, clothes adorn naked bodies in both fabric and ideology, becoming sites which exhibit the wearer's tastes, wealth, power, gender, and race, among other signifiers. Similarly to early gender studies, women were seen as a natural subject of clothing research, as they offer a chance to both explore a subject where women were increasingly empowered through consumption and self-display, while also being able to deconstruct the burdens of gendered meaning relegated almost exclusively to the bodies of people with the least social power. Though men's clothing consumption and dress have remained less well studied, one site of increasing scholarship is military dress, which reveals the importance of gender hierarchy in clothing for men. The uniforms of the Army and Navy were purchased and designed by men for men, often by high-ranking officers and administrators for subordinate officers and soldiers. Over the course of the 18th century, the British state slowly began consolidating the role of designing and dressing soldiers, so that uniforms went from being displays of a commander's personal wealth, taste, and power, to more uniformly designed declarations of state power. Additionally, uniforms were embellished with iconography, which not only placed them on a military and social hierarchy, but also celebrated the historical military achievements of their group, which placed them as inheritors of masculine combat prowess and imperial conquest. The Royal Navy's uniform clothing, while often following trends from the Army, deserves consideration because the nature of naval service resisted visual and institutional centralization. Oddly, the first uniformed group in the Royal Navy was the Royal Marines. Though still ostensibly controlled by the Army until 1755, the responsibility of contracting uniforms for the Marines was transferred to the Navy Board by at least 1747. Royal Navy officers did not receive a uniform until 1748. Their blue coats contrasted sharply and pointedly with the Marine scarlet, a color the Royal Marines inherited from their time as part of the Army. Finally, naval sailors were not clothed in uniforms for another century, until 1857. Sailors, however, did wear mass-produced state-regulated clothes called slops. These clothing items were based on civilian seafaring garments. They were contractually defined through official patterns, physical examples of the actual garments, which the board considered for their quality and fit. Marines also wore slops when it was not appropriate to wear their uniform. The varied clothes worn in the naval service makes it a particularly robust source of clothing problems, both as physical supply issues but also as sites of conflicting ideology. Therefore, despite being a relatively minor part of its duties, the clothing systems of the Royal Navy highlight the complex negotiations required between all levels of its hierarchies for it to function. The Board of Admiralty and the Navy Board made decisions about the contracted clothing. Dockyard workers and storekeepers inspected and delivered the clothes to naval vessels and transport tenders. Ship officers and pursers received and distributed the clothes on behalf of the government to sailors whose consumption of the slops was not entirely voluntary. The cost of the garments was subtracted from their wages. Officers and pursers, as government representatives to the crew, often bore the brunt of crew dissatisfaction with a whole range of issues, including clothing. Because of this, commanders used paternal language to highlight their careful and considerate management of their crew's well-being when they wrote to the Admiralty. This care was not charity, however. Commanders expected that their paternal attention would be reciprocated by sailors and Marines through deference and hard labor. In addition, paternal language was used to cash criticisms of supply shortcomings and to pass the cost of additional supplies on to the state. No letters to the Admiralty better illustrate the various layers of power negotiation by a commander than those complaining about naval slops delivered to Admiral Nelson's Mediterranean Squadron in August 1804. Nelson, already a long-standing British hero of the Battle of the Nile and the bombardment of Copenhagen, was especially able to use the power of his celebrity to inflame the language of paternal care. Therefore, it is important to remember that his letters were uncommonly aggressive and should not be construed as the normal tone used to write to the Admiralty. Instead, Nelson's lack of subtlety brings to the fore how commanders more broadly use paternal duty to manipulate the Admiralty. It also renders the suggestion by Brockless and his co-authors that he was acting mother-like particularly ridiculous. Nelson wrote to the Admiralty that the clothes received were made of worse fabric and were more expensive than usual. He explained that the expected Russian duck, a tough, waterproof light canvas fabric, was replaced with coarse wrapper stuff, essentially a roughly woven fabric. Originally, the canvas clothes cost 4 shillings 8 pence for frocks and 4 shillings for trousers. Those delivered by the Diligent were 2 to 3 pence more expensive, making the frocks in particular almost 5 shillings. Unimpressed, Nelson wrote, "The issuing of such coarse stuff to the people, who have been accustomed to good Russian duck cheaper, will no doubt occasion murmurs and discontent, and may result in serious consequences. I therefore am most decidedly of the opinion that the contractor who furnished such stuff ought to be hanged, and little less, if anything, is due to those who have received them from him. I shall say no more on the subject, as their lordships will naturally see the propriety of this evil being remedied as soon as possible." Nelson's threats are interesting and varied. First, he outlines how the deficient clothes will affect crew morale, reminding the Admiralty that the consequences of improperly supplying the people could result in murmurs and discontent, a not very subtle euphemism for mutiny. Only 7 years after the debacles at Spithead and the Nore, as well as the violent loss of the Hermione, this almost explicit caution about mutiny was a bit heavy-handed. While other commanders wrote to the Admiralty about their responsibility to act as fair providers to their crews, with the implication that failing to do so might end in crew violence, this was almost always implied rather than explicitly stated. He continued by passing capital judgment on the contractor who produced the clothing, as well as those who have received them from him, which could mean either the Navy Board who accepted the contract or the storekeepers in England who received the bales of slops and supposedly inspected them for quality. Discontent with contractors during this period was common, but a commander writing to the Admiralty and threatening violence against the contractor, in addition to the associated naval personnel, was not. In June 1805, Rear Admiral Thomas Troubridge wrote about the same issue, maybe even the same contractor, when he received inferior, coarse slops while stationed at Madras. His language is more careful than Nelson's, writing that, "I would rather their lordships would be pleased to cause an inquiry to be made respecting them," and adding that, "I am of the opinion that there has been some gross imposition on the part of the contractor." Still, while Troubridge's language was not as extreme as Nelson's, it is clear that he and his captain, Austin Bizzle, were both invested in monitoring the quality of clothing which their crew received. Nelson concluded his letter by adding a postscript about Hardy's research into cotton trousers and frocks from Malta. When Nelson returned some clothing from the Diligent, as proof of their poor quality, he also included some examples of Hardy's Maltese cotton. This highlights the real quandary of receiving inferior slops in a distant station from a tender sent from England. The sailors needed clothes, and it would take time to receive replacements. Troubridge's solution was to allow the inferior slop clothes to be sold, but at a reduced price, the hope being that the Admiralty would recoup the cost by penalizing the slop contractor and not his crew, his purser, or himself. Nelson's strategy was different. While he may have issued the slops at a reduced price as well, the addition of the slops from Malta revealed that Nelson was prepared to diversify his supply chain through local Mediterranean sources. While at the surface the suggestion of Maltese cotton might seem like a helpful suggestion, the aggressive tone of the letters suggests that the foreign slops were more likely a challenge to the Admiralty's position of paternal authority. This conflict between the Admiralty and ship commanders over who had control over the ship's supplies is further highlighted in the letter Nelson forwarded by Captain Henry William Baton, the captain of HMS Leviathan. Like Nelson, Baton maligned the quality of the Diligent slops by writing a long, scathing commentary on both the slops themselves and the process which allowed such supplies to be delivered to his ship. In his letter, Baton explicitly challenged the Navy Board's authority as the site of quality control. He wrote, "I further beg leave to call to your Lordship's attention to the very judicious regulations in the General Printed Instructions on the subject of slop clothing, Article 1st, page 71. According to this, a pattern marked with the Navy Board seal should be sent to His Majesty's ships with all slops, and if the clothes are found to be inferior, they are permitted to make a deduction in the price, acting with fairness between the slop seller and the men." This refers to the slop clothes section of the Regulations and Instructions Relating to His Majesty's Service at Sea, a set of naval regulations which, until 1806, were primarily about the duties of naval captains. The instructions were originally issued in 1731, and in the 73 years between that date and 1804, when Baton referred to them, they had only received minor revisions. The next issue of the instructions, which did not arrive until 1806, was its first major overhaul. The slop section itself almost doubled in length, and significantly the entirety of slop management was moved from the control of the captain to that of the purser. Over the course of the French Wars, the Admiralty and Navy Board were in the process of centralizing slop management, and Baton had noticed. "Why is it discontinued?" he asked about sending the slop patterns. "Is it because we are not to have it in our power to see justice done to the men under our command, and that we may not be a check upon and bring to the light the malpractices of contractors? The General Printed Instructions are referred to frequently enough by the gentlemen at the Navy Board whenever it answers their purpose to remind officers of their duty, but I am sorry they have forgot or do neglect that particular instruction to which I have called your Lordship's attention." A year later, Troubridge wrote that he consulted the instructions as well. He decided to distribute his inferior slops at a reduced rate as per instructions, but never mentions that he used the contractor's samples to determine their quality. It is probable that Troubridge pragmatically admitted that he lacked a pattern, instead choosing to follow the parts of the regulations which allowed him to distribute the inferior clothes in a way which both kept his crew happy by reducing the cost, and also by following the spirit of the regulations, hopefully pleasing the Admiralty as well. Baton, however, was not finished admonishing the Diligent slops. Having recently returned from about a decade of service in the Caribbean, he additionally reflected on clothing he had witnessed in the West Indies to further malign the quality of the slop clothes. He compared the cloth to number 7 sail canvas as inferior in texture and color. He then continued that, "The article is so inferior that I think them only fit to be sold to the Negroes in the West Indies. They are exactly like what I have seen there for that purpose, exposed to sale, and by no means fit for British seamen." His comparison of slop clothes with clothing for that purpose is significant and revealing. First, the insinuation that free British seamen were to be clothed in slops, which, Baton charged, were no better than those sold in bulk to plantations to clothe their enslaved workers, was an extremely loaded comparison. Indeed, while the language of liberty and slavery was used at all levels of political power as a rhetorical tool, the specific use of it in the Navy again recalls the mutinies of 1797. Sailors used this dichotomy specifically to underline the rights they expected as free British military personnel who were due, among other things, access to well-made clothing and not contractor-manipulated rags overpriced by the burden of the purser's pound. This was also directly tied to a broader British use of such rhetoric over the course of the French Wars, positioning British liberty as the righteous antithesis of French despotism. Baton's comparison was not purely theoretical, however. A closer look at auctions and store inventories published in the British Caribbean show that slops and clothes intended for enslaved plantation workers were also closely associated. Of particular interest are the numerous printed advertisements in Guyanese newspapers. Between 1797 and 1814, the contents of ships arriving from Britain were published in English newspapers. These advertisements contain a staggering assortment of privately sourced goods deemed marketable in the South American colony, including large shipments of clothing and fabric. Frequently, slop clothing and clothing for enslaved workers were listed together. In 39 advertisements between 1803 and 1813, half the listings which included slops listed them alongside Negro clothing. Though slops appeared alongside ready-made and general clothing intended for gentlemen, women, and children, clothing for the enslaved were very seldom listed near those for general wear. Baton was likely drawing on his own experience in the West Indies to make this comparison, where he no doubt witnessed naval seafarers and enslaved laborers intermingling on shore in port towns and dockyards. Indeed, the difference between the two categories was probably minor. Slops were probably only of slightly better quality when new, and due to the harsh effects of maritime labor on clothes, they probably did not remain very long in a pristine state. Additionally, their proximity in the Guyanese advertisements belies that they were made and shipped under much the same circumstances as mass-produced, cheap apparel, whether it was for the enslaved or for civilian consumers. Sailors, in order to maintain their status as free Britons in both actuality and also appearance, were thus due all the more careful diligence to maintain the quality of their apparel, a duty which Baton argued the Navy Board was failing. Many commanders wrote letters like those highlighted here. Home Popham, who bought fabric in Buenos Aires for his invasion force in 1806, spent 2 years arguing to have their costs waived by the Admiralty by emphasizing the cold weather and the loyalty of his men. Between 1806 and 1809, several commanders wrote glowing testimonials to the Admiralty about worsted underwear. They understood not only the value of good clothes, but also how to shop for them. These testimonials were also convincing. The contractor Thomas Hutchin was still selling his worsted underwear to the Navy in 1823. Despite the confrontational language used by both Nelson and Baton, Brockless and his co-authors mistook their paternal care as matronly fussing. This language, however, both removes men from the history of clothing and vilifies women for being concerned with appearance and material goods. Men and women both had to worry about clothes, yet even when men like Nelson are caught in the act, language which mocks his concern makes it easy to ignore male consumption and by extension the politics of the male body. Part of the toxicity of masculinity is that all other bodies, those which are female, racialized, disabled, or queer, are made to exclusively carry burdens of meaning. A wider search through naval letters to the Admiralty reveals that concerns about clothes were common and important. Sailors had to be clothed, and since they paid for the privilege, they needed to be clothed with care. The arrival of the diligent tender and the subsequent letters following its arrival show that providing clothing was not just something to fuss over, but an important issue which concerned administration, commanders, and crew, and revealed the paternal politics through which the Navy functioned during the French Revolutionary and Napoleonic Wars.